Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. And by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We don't usually waste time telling you what didn't happen. Not a very efficient way to run a news program, I'd say. But there was a non-happening in Europe today that deserves a mention. Interest rates there didn't go down. So what? Stay tuned. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 7th of February today. It is a global economy that we live in. That much isn't really open to debate. Still, intelligent people can disagree about what's happening in that economy. We know what Ben Bernanke thinks. He and the Federal Open Market Committee have made it clear they're worried about a slowdown, the traditional remedy for which is interest rate cuts. Today, Jean-Claude Trichet, Mr. Bernanke's opposite number at the European Central Bank, pointedly missed a chance to follow suit. The ECB held its short-term rate steady at 4%, the same place it's been last summer. And it's a decision to stand pat that could affect the U.S. economy. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from the European desk in London.
Here's a curious thing. Inflation is higher in the U.S. than in Europe, and yet the Fed has been slashing interest rates while the ECB has kept them on hold. Today's non-move by the ECB points up a vivid contrast. The Fed is terrified of recession. Martin Wolf is chief economics commentator of the Financial Times. He says the ECB is not that worried about the slowdown already underway in Europe.
This is not expected to be anything like as severe a downturn in the Eurozone as a whole, as it is now almost universally believed it will be in the United States.
Today's inaction by the ECB could help the US economy, reducing the trade deficit. If the ECB holds rates steady while the Fed cuts, the dollar could fall further, making US exports cheaper.
But on the whole, it is more likely than not that the dollar will continue to fall as interest rates in the US continue to decline, and that will tend to help US exports a bit.
Of course, all this depends on whether the ECB has got it right. The bank has a tough job, setting one interest rate for 15 countries. It assumes that overall the European economy will remain reasonably buoyant. Graham Mather is with the European Policy Forum.
Everyone's still watching very closely in case there's more write-offs, more bad news from the banking sector in the US having knock-on effects in Europe. And people are not at all persuaded that we're out of the woods there.
And we might have been here before. After the dot-com bust, many European economists said that Europe would be immune. But Europe suffered 4 years of stagnation. The US recovered more quickly. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Mitt Romney has simplified the race for the Republican presidential nomination. You might remember he didn't do all that well on Tuesday. Today, the former governor of Massachusetts pulled the plug. He is officially suspending his campaign. That means he still controls the delegates he has won. It also means he can stop writing personal checks to float his campaign. Romney wouldn't have gotten as far as he did without his personal fortune. He's said to be worth a couple of $100 million. He spent a sizable chunk of it trying to get to the White House. But now that he's out, what did a savvy businessman like Romney get for his investment? Here's Jeremy Hobson.
We know Mitt Romney gave his campaign more than $35 million before any votes had been cast. Soon we'll know what he gave in January. But let's say in all, he spent more than $40 million. That means he spent more than $10 of his own money per vote. Steve Forbes ran for president in 1996 and 2000. He says between the two races, he spent $60 million of his own money.
My kids would say it was too much. Looking at the result, I'd probably say it wasn't enough since I didn't win.
But Forbes says he got the issue of the flat tax out there, and for that, he's happy. He also gave a little boost to the name recognition of the Forbes brand.
You have it for a while, but then memories fade. New things come up in the news. So the key thing is the ideas, and I think in the case of Mitt Romney, what I think he's looking for clearly is perhaps another shot in 2012.
I wouldn't be surprised at all to see him make another run.
Kimberly Field co-wrote a book called Mitt Romney, The Man, His Values, and His Vision. She says he's achieved what he wanted to in the private sector and is after the top job, nothing less.
And I think Mitt Romney, the CEO, would tell you that when you look at investments, you need to look long-term.
On that score, perhaps his failed bid was a good long-term investment. In the last 30 years, Republicans have made a habit of nominating the guy who came in second the last time around. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Presidential politics aside, business in Washington continues apace. The Senate passed the economic stimulus plan this afternoon. Extra rebates for the elderly and some disabled veterans. Otherwise, it's pretty much the same one that passed the House last week. And those gift cards you got for Christmas, retailers would really appreciate it if you pulled them out and used them. Most big chains reported disappointing January sales today. They don't get to count the revenue on those cards until they're cashed in, and that's what they blamed for their January slowdown. It's not every day you get to use names like Tommy Sneakers and Jackie the Nose on a business program, but sometimes you just get lucky. U.S. and Italian police arrested scores of suspected mobsters in New York City and Sicily today, among them some of the capos of the Gambino crime family. Charges include racketeering, conspiracy, embezzlement of union funds, and money laundering. That's just a sampling.
The mafia's influence has waned over the years, but FBI agent Jim Margolin says the mob still has a significant economic impact. They're still deeply involved in the construction industry, judging by today's indictment. But Margolin says a few years ago, members of the Gambino family thought up a couple of more white-collar schemes.
One of which involved telephone cramming, which was a system whereby pennies per transaction charges were tacked on to thousands of telephone users' bills.
Margolin says both enterprises together netted the family $500 million. He says the mafia has also dabbled in stock manipulation. That's a world away from the mob's traditional areas of control, like the transportation business or the docks. Larry McShane of the New York Daily News has covered organized crime for 20 years. He says the mafia would slap a tariff on goods coming into U.S. ports.
A lot of products coming in on the waterfront, that was the case. The term that law enforcement uses is a mob tax. You know, an extra dollar or two on the cost of items that just goes back to them, just like a normal tax would go to the government.
Retired federal agent Joe King teaches at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He says the mafia is still going strong in cities like Philadelphia, Atlantic City, Vegas, Boston, and New Orleans, but they're particularly active in New York, mostly due to their involvement in the unions.
I would be willing to bet you that any union that's worth its weight has infiltration of some kind, if not at the highest level, then behind the scenes level. The truck drivers, the garment industry.
He says given the amount of money and business unions control, they're still an irresistible hunting ground for the mob. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Traders didn't feel threatened today by the mob or anything else. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Don't stop.
Today marks a grim Lunar New Year in most of southern China.
Last week, the region was hit with powerful snowstorms that knocked out electricity to millions of people. They also derailed travel plans for hundreds of millions more who were planning trips home to see family. Migrant workers were among the most severely affected. They only get to go home but once a year for this holiday. Scott Tong is in our Shanghai bureau. Hey, Scott.
Kai, Happy New Year from China.
Xinyan kuai le, as it were, I guess, huh?
That's right.
Listen, these migrant workers, they are all over the place in China, as you've been telling us about for the past couple of years. Remind us exactly who we're talking about.
Well, let's talk about the Tong family nanny. We put her on a bus about 3 days ago to go back to her village. So she spent most of her adult life outside the village, and she's come to the city for work. And her husband works in a different city. He's also a migrant, and he's an electrician. Now, take that times 200 million, and that's the kind of movement of humanity that we're seeing in China. And this is basically their one vacation every year. Except this year, when Mother Nature intervened here and we had the 100-year snowstorm in parts of China, which shut down highways, canceled flights, downed a lot of power lines, so a lot of people were stranded.
What does this tell us about the Chinese infrastructure? I mean, obviously the country's growing and it's trying to equip itself for life in the modern economy. What do we know now that we didn't know a week and a half ago?
Well, for starters, the infrastructure in China is fabulous for the most part. But a storm like this reveals stress points, and one of those is the power grid here in China. China runs largely on coal, and so these power plants need coal that's mined in northern China and needs to be transported all around the country. And what happened with this storm is the supply and the transportation was disrupted. And so the government had to start this massive response to keep all the lights on. They told ships that were exporting coal to turn around and bring it back into China. They reopened these mines that they'd shut down because they were too dangerous. So they mobilized this giant response to keep the lights on, to keep the factories going in China. And a lot of the power plants, they only have a few days of coal left, so we still may have some harrowing times to go, and it may affect the export machine here.
Well, let me pick up on that thread and channel the American consumer here. China is the factory of the world. We see their goods on our shelves all over the place. What might this mean for China as an export engine and the rest of the world economy?
Well, most people think, as far as the storm, that China Inc. is going to be back and up and running pretty soon. But you have this longer-term fundamental energy question here in China, and it comes back to price controls. There are fears about inflation and prices of everything going up in China, and so the government has regulated the price of a lot of things, including energy. Now, that's good for buyers, but it's terrible for the sellers, right? Say I'm selling you something. I'm selling Oreos to you. And the government says I can only sell them for like 5 cents a pack. Well, I'm not going to invest a lot. I'm not going to put a lot on the shelves. And that's what the power plants have done here in China. They don't have a lot of extra reserve because they don't have a financial incentive to do that. And that's a longer-term question about China and energy.
Briefly, Scott, before I let you go, what's your guess as to whether or not your nanny is going to be back on time?
Well, we've told her to call us or send us a text message if the weather's bad, and we could be in for some freezing rain and some fog here. So come next Wednesday, when everybody is supposed to come back to their jobs and to the factories, we'll see if everybody makes it back smoothly.
Scott Tong at the Marketplace Bureau in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
Okay, Kai. Thanks a lot.
The National Association of Realtors delivered the latest drip of bad news about the housing market today. Pending home sales stalled at the end of last year. Unfortunately, the other side of the ledger in home sales is booming. Foreclosures have been breaking records for months now. The U.S. Conference of Mayors estimates cities will lose more than $160 billion as a result. And that doesn't even count the human part of the equation, like the story of commentator Kevin Mims.
27 years ago, my wife and I lost our home to foreclosure. She and I and my two young stepdaughters lived there for less than 2 years, but it was our first home together. We loved it. My wife and I met while working together at a title and escrow company. Now a real estate slump had cost us our jobs. The foreclosure process took several months. It felt like a death watch. Eventually, the bank came along and pulled the plug. Afterwards, we swore we'd never allow ourselves to become emotionally attached to another house. We moved frequently, so it was easy to keep our vow. But 4 years ago, we bought an 80-year-old home in a nice Sacramento neighborhood. My wife, an escrow officer, and I, a notary public, were earning good money. We had every intention of staying here forever. But the subprime lending crisis has triggered another real estate meltdown. Now my wife's salary has been cut and her bonuses eliminated. My notary work has dwindled to a trickle. It becomes more difficult to make our house payment each month. Financially, it doesn't make sense to even try. We owe about $430,000 on the house. It's currently worth no more than $400,000. Selling isn't an option. Sooner or later, we will probably give up another home to foreclosure. The interest rate is competitive, 6 1/8, and it's fixed until August 2012. A sudden upward adjustment of our loan won't force us out. It's the sudden decrease in our incomes. I suspect foreclosure will be much more difficult at 50-something than it was at 20-something. We've imprinted our personalities on this place more than we ever did on our first home. On the bright side, my stepdaughters are grown up. We won't have to uproot them. The only downside for them is they may end up housing us for a while.
Freelance writer Kevin Mims lives in Sacramento, California. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, a Q&A on your 401k.
How much of my money is being withdrawn every month or every quarter or every year for the management of the account, and is it a reasonable amount?
We'll find out, but first, let's do the numbers. Investors eyed the bargain racks of devalued stocks today. The Dow Industrials rose 46 points, one-third of 1% to 12,247. The NASDAQ rose 14 points, nearly two-thirds of 1%, 2293 at the bell. The S&P 500 rose 10 points, eight-tenths%, 1336 is the number you're looking for there. There was a bit of a retail rally despite that slowing January sales report that I mentioned. JCPenney popped up 8.5%. Gap got a 7% bump. Target climbed 6%. The airline industry gained altitude on reports of a preliminary merger talk. Since preliminary merger talks, Delta flew up 3%. Northwest drifted up 0.1%. United Airlines got a 5% lift. Continental caught a tailwind of nearly 6%. Overseas, London's FTSE dropped nearly 2.5%. The Paris CAC 40 soured at nearly 2%. The Nikkei plummeted 4.7%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.78%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
For the Marketplace Datebook, here is a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, Congress has its say about the Microsoft-Yahoo deal. The House Antitrust Task Force takes a look at the massive merger. President Bush tours damage caused by deadly tornadoes in Tennessee. And start your engines. The 100th annual Chicago Auto Show kicks into gear today. I'm Jennifer Collins.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Phoenix, Arizona got a post-Super Bowl boost yesterday. The NBA's Phoenix Suns announced they've traded for Shaquille O'Neal. The guy might be a little bit past his prime, I know, but he is 7'1", and he does weigh 325 pounds, so he'll still be a force to be reckoned with. At a press conference in Phoenix today, he all but promised big things.
Start selling the T-shirts now, all the marketing people. I'm giving you this one for free. The sun will rise in Phoenix.
It's been a big week for the capital of the Grand Canyon State, and Diana Nyad says things there are only going to get better. Hey, Diana.
Kai, what's going on?
Not much, but you heard the big man say it. Phoenix will rise. What do you think?
You know, I actually think he's a little behind the times. He's talking about the Suns, but when he talks about Phoenix and sports, Phoenix has risen. I mean, this place is touted now as the sports mecca of America. You know, Kai, look, you know, you would think, you know, what idiot sports organizers would want to plan on the same weekend as the Super Bowl, in the same town as the Super Bowl, the granddaddy, the top of the mountain of all sporting events? Who would plan another sporting event? Well, the extremely popular PGA event, men's golf, the FBR Open, played the same weekend. And you know what? At the end of the count of attendance, 500,000 people, more, actually were at that golf tournament over those 4 days, which is really about the same number who attended the Super Bowl. It was a wild weekend for sports.
All right, but you know, there's this other thing that happens in this country, baseball, and Arizona is home to the Cactus League, spring training for a lot of teams. What about that?
You got 12 teams already there. The Dodgers have already announced, not for this spring training, but by next year, they're going to be, you know, in town, close by Phoenix. Evidently, the Indians are looking to go there. It's, you know, to my mind, the big picture, Kai, is what happened is when 9/11 came down, the leaders of business in Phoenix decided that they were going to put a lot of their city dollars, their tax revenue, towards sports, and they started building. They built it, and everybody's coming.
What about that, though? I mean, you know, the stadium out there, University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale, Arizona, it's gorgeous to look at, state-of-the-art, but it is taxpayer-financed. Is the city and the surrounding area getting its money back now?
Well, if you look at the, you know, the real simple sort of macro numbers, the stadium cost $455 million. The Super Bowl alone brought in more than $400 million. So, you know, you can just look at it, you know, tit for tat and say, okay, that got paid for in what, 3 hours? Now, I guess there are, you know, economics professors who will break it down and say, yeah, well, it's not a model that works, you know, in every city across America. But in Phoenix, there's a group of businessmen called the Thunderbirds. They are convinced that, especially because of the good weather, that, you know, building these stadia, at least in this particular environment, is definitely worth it for the taxpayers of Phoenix.
So what's coming up for Phoenix? I mean, the Super Bowl now is old hat.
The Super Bowl's old hat, but, you know, Phoenix is going to host the NBA All-Star Game next year. The Dodgers are coming into town to, you know, use Phoenix as their spring training next year. There's a big push courting the NCAA for a Final Four showdown down the road. Usually that isn't orchestrated for 5 or 6 years, you know, in advance. But the bonanza is in full swing in Phoenix where, you know, all sports, all the time, all year, and the Super Bowl was just sort of a metaphor for how big the sports community is down there and how successful it is.
All right, quickly now, what do you think of the Suns' chances, though, to get back to Shaq?
I guess I feel like a lot of people do. You know, basketball fans who love Shaq and love his whole mojo know that he's in the twilight of his career. Doesn't mean that he can't still, you know, manage and control under the basket. But the great quality of the Phoenix Suns is their speed. And if they play Shaq ball, they're going to have to play slow ball. So I'm not sure, entirely sure, it's going to be a great basketball move, pure basketball move.
Diana Nyad and the Business of Sports. Thank you, Diana.
Kai, thank you so much.
More than 50 million workers in this country currently have 401k plans. Altogether, they've set aside $3 trillion for their retirements. But unbeknownst to most of them, some of those 401ks could be losing money. Besides, in the stock market, I mean, through hidden fees and conflicts of interest. The Labor Department's proposed some new rules on disclosure. The public comment period on them closes tomorrow. Tess Vigeland hosts our personal finance program, Marketplace Money. And today she wraps up our coverage of those buried 401k fees with a look at what you're allowed to know right now.
Mitch Aldrich is big on saving for retirement. Lucky for him, the radiology firm he works for in Minnetonka, Minnesota, sponsors 401k accounts for all of its employees. And Aldrich funnels 25% of his salary into that plan.
Anything else, guys?
No.
Excellent. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
His day job is to make sure the company's technology is up to date and working.
We may already have this, but this is the first quarter technology priorities.
But for all his high-tech and management wisdom, Aldridge can't figure out the answer to this one question.
How much of my money is being withdrawn every month or every quarter or every year for the management of the account
And is it a reasonable amount?
He knows about the expense ratios for each of the mutual funds in his 401k, and he knows he pays a quarterly administration fee. But he suspects there's a little more to it.
I couldn't find any numbers that made any sense to me. I spent probably an afternoon searching, and I sent a few emails, and then I finally just gave up.
And for good reason. Even the experts have a tough time figuring out the math. Matthew Hutchison is a pension consultant in Portland, Oregon.
I performed an analysis a few months ago, and it took me several days of looking through many hundreds of pages of documents and contracts and so forth of a company who had 10 or 15 funds. A normal participant wouldn't know where to look.
Hutchison has testified on Capitol Hill to support full disclosure of 401k fees. He and others, including several members of Congress, believe if people knew more about the fees, they'd put more pressure on fund companies to keep costs down. The 401k industry does support better fee disclosure, but wonders how much detail is really necessary. David Ray heads up the profit-sharing 401k Council of America.
It's like a person who buys a car. They want to know what the price of the car is. They don't want to know what the price of the engine is, what the price of the front door handle is. What they want to know is what's the total cost.
Ray supports the idea of a simple spreadsheet so that 401k participants won't have to dig through the prospectus of each mutual fund they own. But he says the industry is concerned that employees could be so overwhelmed by fee disclosures that they simply stop investing.
We don't want to give them information that they can't handle. I mean, we can barely explain what a stock and a bond is to a participant, and to explain how all these fee structures work to them, I think, is really beyond the system.
Hutchison thinks the industry isn't giving investors enough credit. After all, he says, they already have to pick individual mutual funds on their own.
When the FDA required food companies to disclose nutritional information on the back of food packages, did you become overwhelmed and stop eating?
Back in Minnetonka, Mitch Aldridge admits he doesn't want to sift through pages and pages of fee information.
But what I think people will care about is the bottom line. What's the actual dollar amount that I'm essentially losing each year, and how that compounds?
It may be a long time before he's able to figure that out. A Department of Labor proposal would force 401k fund managers to give more details to employers, but employees still have to do their own digging. And as Mitch Aldrich has learned, it takes a lot of fancy spade work to unearth the full extent of those fees. In Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland for Marketplace.
We've got a link to those Labor Department rules Tess mentioned. You can offer your comments there, and you can link to a site where you can look up some of your plan's fees. It's online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, giving away money for a living is no easy thing. It's even harder when you're the CEO of the $38 billion Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, by far the largest foundation in the world. Patty Stonecipher has announced she'll be stepping down next year. The foundation distributes more than $3 billion annually, most of it to fund global health initiatives and U.S. education. Gates himself has said he's going to spend more time on the foundation and less at Microsoft starting sometime this summer. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow plumped up 46 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq gained 14.6%. The S&P 500 added on 10 points. That is 0.8%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, builders try to figure out the housing bust.
Hey, I got to live with it. You know, what am I going to do? Stay awake and worry about it? Can't do that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.